Well, what do you do if you're an exceptionally bright young person growing up in rural Ontario and all you really want to do is go to Mars? Well, Elon Musk still has some issues to work out with his terrestrial vehicle production before he starts booking tickets for a Mars expedition. And so for Kate Harris, she decided to work out her wanderlust in another way by traveling the Silk Road from Turkey to Tibet by bicycle. She's just published a memoir of her adventures. It's called Lands of Lost Borders. And Kate joins us this morning here on the Jefferson Exchange. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for being with us. Now, are you calling in from your off-the-grid cabin in the Yukon?
I'm actually not. I'm back in rural Ontario for the moment in my parents' place. I've got a bunch of book events on the east coast of Canada and the U.S. coming up, so I'm currently away from the cabin.
Okay.
Back on grid.
So, this is a good location for my first question. So from your description in your book, your childhood in rural Ontario really sounds idyllic. I mean, you had supportive parents, a couple of brothers to romp around with in the countryside, a fair amount of freedom, but you still had this sort of really intense wanderlust when you were growing up. Where do you think that came from?
Oh, I blame books mostly. I think books planted all kinds of wild notions in my mind as far as, you know, what was possible in the world and where you could go and what you could see and the kinds of adventures you could have. And for whatever reason, I mean, my parents are avid readers, and so there were always books piled around the house, and we were always encouraged to read. But I was an obsessive reader. I really lived in worlds and first came to know the world through words more than direct experience beyond, you know, playing around in the woods in southern Ontario.
And a lot of your wanderlust or your desire to be elsewhere centered on the planet Mars. How did that develop?
Yeah, well, I think as a result of reading all these books about mostly historical narratives of exploration, I got the impression that the world was pretty mapped and tamed and fenced, that it was old news, in short. And I felt like I'd been born too late to sort of live out the spirit of exploration that really possessed me. I was a restless kid, really curious about everything. And in small-town Ontario, you know, I could see subdivisions and farmland and fences. And based on the books I read, I kind of figured that the whole world looked like that now. It was all seen and done and mapped, and exploration was over. And so I figured I had to leave this world behind in the most literal sense and become an astronaut and a scientist and aim for Mars if I wanted to be an explorer in this day and age.
And so among all these books, you discovered Marco Polo.
Yeah, that was a favorite when I was quite little. So my mom had this illustrated, abridged edition of his travels that was aimed at children. And so it was full of, you know, romantic illustrations of Polo pulling camels across exotic deserts and traversing huge mountain ranges, all these sort of landscapes that I had no notion of beyond sort of pixels and words on a page as a kid. And I was just enthralled. He seemed to me the epitome of an explorer, and I really wanted to be just like him when I grew up. But it wasn't until, I guess I was at university, when I read the unabridged edition of his travels, which doesn't have the same number of illustrations, and it sort of drones on and on about commodities on the Silk Road and his focus. I mean, Polo was a merchant more than an explorer, and his focus in the unabridged edition was on what could be bought and sold along the Silk Road. And so it was so far from what drew me to the Silk Road in the first place as a kid. And I felt pretty let down. He was a fallen hero at that point because he basically lamented and criticized all the landscapes that I loved, you know, the deserts and mountains that drew me to the Silk Road.
He was really irritated by things that were getting in the way of making money.
Exactly, standing in the way of progress and profit.
And so another major inspiration you had was Alexandra David Neal, who It sounds like, as I read through your books, she's the only one that still sort of consistently inspired you.
Yeah, she was a remarkable woman, a really quirky character, too. She, at the age of 55, in the year 1924, she disguised herself as a Buddhist pilgrim and snuck into Tibet, snuck all the way to Lhasa, which was pretty forbidden to Europeans, certainly, at that time. And the people doing the forbidding were Tibetan authorities as opposed to Chinese officials like today. And so I just thought she was this incredible, bold, fearless, intrepid explorer. And she was really the only female explorer I stumbled across, at least at a young age, that sort of, you know, she wasn't traveling the world to find herself. She wasn't hitting the open road because she wanted to escape some kind of crisis back home, whether, you know, loss or love's end, which is so often the motivation that you hear about, at least in sort of popular culture these days. Like, when a woman hits the road, it's often because something went wrong back home or she's trying to find something.
Our guest this morning is Kate Harris, and we're talking about her new memoir, Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road. We have a lot more of the road to travel, and we'll do that after a break here on the Jefferson Exchange. It's the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm John Baxter, and we're talking this morning with Kate Harris. She's just published a new memoir of her travels along the Silk Road by bicycle. It's called Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road. You can join the conversation by calling us this morning at 800-838-3760. You can also send us an email if you have a question. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Kate, we were talking about Alexandra David Neal as one of the real inspirations for you, because she was just intensely curious, and you mentioned that she made her trip to Tibet just because she wanted to, not because she was, you know, she had a relationship that broke up or whatever. And you mentioned that you see a lot of the exploration books in this day and age sort of motivated by factors other than the sheer curiosity.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know what that's a function of. I mean, I think there are plenty of women out there doing amazing things just for the sake of doing amazing things, for the intensity and exhilaration of travel and exploration. But at least what's represented in films and a lot of books is a different story. And it seems like if you're a guy, then a trip alone is reason enough to go and write about it. But with women, I think there's more pressure to have sort of, some kind of crisis that prompts adventure and travel. And I don't think that needs to be the case, and it isn't the case for so many women, and it's important to model that in our literature for, you know, the young future would-be explorers of years to come.
So at what point did you decide to bike the Silk Road? I mean, your first trip was just part of the route.
That's right. We biked in a bridge section of Silk Road on our first journey, which was inspired mostly by Marco Polo falling out of my favor. I read an abridged edition of his travels and decided I wanted to hit the Silk Road that he had traveled in China, but celebrate it for all the reasons that he lamented it. So go to its wildest corners, its remotest deserts and mountains, and focus on those hinterlands, so-called hinterlands, as opposed to the trading hubs that he celebrated. And a bicycle just seems more manageable than a camel caravan in this day and age.
Camels, horses, bicycles. I have to say that one of my dream trips, I ride a bicycle a lot, is to ride across the United States of America. And then I read in your book that you did that just as a warm-up for your Silk Road trip. I was rather humbled by that.
Oh, I would highly, highly recommend it. It was one of the grandest adventures of my life. And I you know, that you can only tell so many stories in a book. And so the U.S. bike trip that my buddy Mal and I launched on, I guess it was in 2005, doesn't get much coverage, but it was an incredible adventure. And this is something I really want to emphasize to people that are thinking about hitting the road by bicycle and thinking about launching on some kind of journey, but hesitate for whatever reason, or maybe going abroad is too daunting. The most incredible adventures can be had straight out your back door, wherever you happen to live, if you set off by bicycle and are just open to what happens around, you know, whatever bend in the road you meet, you know, the people you're going to meet, the places you're going to explore, and it's as worthy of exploration as the Silk Road, the back roads of America are that is.
So earlier you mentioned that one of the things you wanted to do was become an astronaut and a scientist, and so that took you to Oxford and later on to MIT. Those would be adventures enough for a lot of us. But you still had this obsession with Mars. You ended up actually being at the Mars simulator in Utah. But at some point, when you were at MIT, you had a conversation with a professor that seemed to be the catalyst for your obsession with Mars just kind of flaming out. Can you tell us about that incident in your life?
Sure. Yeah, so I really fixated on Mars as, you know, the last possible venue for exploration, in the sense of a place that really was pretty unmapped, and was also a place people could actually go and walk around and, you know, admire the sunset. So exploration can happen on all scales, and you know, science is certainly proof of that. You know, looking through a microscope at microbial mat is a kind of exploration, but I really wanted to be an explorer on scales that matched my own, so human-sized explorations, and Mars seemed a place to do that. But over the years, both through spending a lot of time in science laboratories with that goal of eventually becoming an astronaut in mind, and then ultimately taking part in this two-week Mars simulation in Utah, and then especially when I was at grad school at MIT, it became clear to me that I was just so ill-suited for that kind of exploring. I don't like feeling contained, and it's a very personal thing. You know, I have huge admiration for scientists and people that study things in laboratories, but I would just feel really, really cramped in those circumstances. And at MIT, you know, there's a whole lot of that kind of exploration going on, and they're unearthing incredible truths and wonders as they do that. But when I was there as a grad student, I had a meeting with a really prominent, phenomenal scientist and human being. But her idea of exploration was looking at Mars on a computer screen, you know, data sent back by rovers and satellites, as opposed to actually going there and getting a sense of the spirit of the place. And I just realized that these were not my people. This was not my tribe. And that's really when I decided to quit grad school and hit the Silk Road.
So this part of the journey isn't really covered a lot in your book, but I wanted to ask you about it. When you were preparing for the Silk Road, you decided to do it again with your friend Mel. The two of you must have spent a lot of time planning for it, just, you know, gathering equipment and saying, well, what kind of bicycle should we take where there are no bike shops, those sorts of things. You know, what kind of support and planning did you need to really make that trip possible?
Yeah, well, between that sort of deciding moment at MIT when I knew I was going to quit this path I'd been on, the scientific path, and seek out other horizons, and the moment we actually took that first pedal stroke on the Silk Road, was about a year of planning and applying to grants to get funding to do the trip. I had no money, neither did Mel. We were dirtbag grad students. And we basically just spent that year hustling to try and put the trip together. And we set off for the journey without enough money to actually finish it and just hoped that things would happen along the way. And we both, you know, we came back in debt from it, but it's the sort of debt that, I don't know, to be young and free and have the world open up before you like that is an extraordinary thing and an opportunity to seize, I think. You can always find a job later and slowly pay back that debt. We wanted to make it happen, and it was this rare period in life when that was possible.
So you started the Silk Road journey after that year of planning in Turkey and actually in Istanbul. And fairly early on, you found some really challenging climatic conditions. Can you talk about that early part of your trip? Because I have to tell you, it sounds kind of miserable.
Oh, it was. I often think about the fact that if that difficult stretch of the Silk Road had happened at the end of the trip when we were so exhausted from nearly a year of biking, we would have given up, I think. We were just so fried. But it happened right at the beginning, and so it was the beginning of the dream, and we were, you know, bright-eyed and fresh. And even then, it was incredibly hard because we hit winter on the Black Sea coast, and we'd figured it was more sensible to start biking in January in Turkey as opposed to starting on the other end of the Silk Road in the Himalaya in winter. And that was probably a wise choice, but it still wasn't easy. The temperature was hovering just around zero, so any rain would sort of be freezing rain or very cold, wet rain. And we were just soaked all the time, and traffic was pretty intense. It was kind of a grim beginning, but it was redeemed, or Turkey for us was redeemed completely by the people we met along the way. I don't know if you can find more generous, hospitable, open people than those who live in Turkey, at least in our experience.
They were actually doing sort of a Kate Harris phone tree, weren't they? They would call you would stay with people, and they would call ahead of the next village and say, hey, there are these two women on bicycles, you know, why don't you put them up for the night?
Yeah, it was incredible. We stayed with this couple early on in the trip, and they had an extra cell phone that they programmed in a bunch of names, and then more and more names would get programmed in as we went because, exactly as you say, we would stay with families, and they'd be like, oh, we have family in, you know, Sinop, a few days down the road. And so they'd put their numbers in and tell them, alert them to us coming. And we'd call these random strangers when we showed up in the next city, and they'd take us in and treat us like lost family. It was absolutely incredible.
We're talking with Kate Harris about her new memoir, Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road, about her journey with her friend Mel by bicycle from Istanbul, Turkey, all the way into Tibet, a long journey that took, I think, almost 10 months. You can join the conversation here on Jefferson Public Radio by phone by calling us at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. One of the themes of your journey, Kate, was sort of environmental. And it seemed to me that kind of served several purposes to you. First of all, it was a passion, but second of all, it was kind of an easy way to explain what the heck you were doing to border agents.
Right. Yeah, we're certainly really fascinated by how relationships between people and place are playing out all along the Silk Road, particularly in the borderlands. There's a lot of contentious borderlands along the route we followed, and you just see the different consequences that fences of all kinds, whether bureaucratic or physical, have for wildlife and wild places and people, of course. So that was sort of the motivating intellectual theme of our trip. I mean, I think at that point, both Mel and I had so many adventures just for the sake of adventure that the idea of spending a year doing nothing but sort of adventuring wasn't so appealing. You know, we'd both been to grad school at that point and really wanted to make our trip a deeper inquiry than just, you know, sheer pedaling. And environmental issues in Borderland was what stood out for us.
So I'm wondering if there's a connection between sort of your waning obsession with Mars and that environmental orientation, because you know, environmental preservation efforts along the Silk Road, you know, served as that focus for you. But there's also that critique of Mars colonization from the environmental perspective that, you know, says, well, hey, we've made such a mess of planet Earth. Why do we think we'd behave differently on Mars? I mean, first of all, do you believe that? And then if so, did that have any kind of relevance to your trip or even afterwards?
It was a huge part of the journey for me, both the trip itself and the writing of the trip into a book. You know, as a kid, I'd really dismissed our planet, our home planet, as a place of diminished possibilities, you know, that subdivision fenced, tamed world of which, I didn't think it was worthy of much attention. And that's partly why I focused so intensely on Mars, because it had the allure of the new and the untouched. And I actually think that's a pretty dangerous attitude to take. And, you know, it's fair. I hadn't seen much of the world as a kid. I knew it only through books. But as I grew older and had the chance to actually get out and see the Tibetan Plateau for myself and travel to Antarctica and just see some of the more far-flung corners of our planet, I just found myself falling more and more in love with it. This world is worthy of, you know, our deepest reverence, and it's a dangerous attitude to think that it's old news. Basically, it's the only home we have in the entire universe that we're aware of, the only place humans can breathe, and yet we treat it like it's a disposable resource. And humans couldn't survive on Mars for any length of time without serious reliance on Earth's resources. And it just seems like focusing on Mars to the exclusion of focusing on what's happening on this planet is not a good way to go. So I finished the trip as a deeply loyal Earthling in a way. I just feel like Mars is a place worthy of exploration, absolutely, but not to the point that we dismiss this planet.
So it also seems, you know, you recount several times in the book where you visited national parks or nature preserves that are being trying to be established by various countries, especially those in the former Soviet Union. But did you find that those were sort of, it seems kind of a little edge of cynicism there, that did you find that they were kind of Potemkin villages maybe that were set up more to attract Western dollars than they were actually serious attempts at preservation?
Well, some were certainly that, and some maybe even more heartbreakingly just had no investment on behalf of the country at all, and so they really just exist on paper, you know, like parks that have no funding and no rangers to reinforce conservation within their borders. And so that was really eye-opening. You know, we think of wilderness conservation and wildlife conservation, national parks, as happening a certain way based on our North American perspective. And then you go to a place like Tajikistan, where, sure, there's populated parks, but they look little different from the landscape around them, other than in some cases being worse for wear, because they're kind of a tragedy of the commons situation when you don't have fines and fences that are backed up by dollars to keep people out. And then perversely, you know, also in Tajikistan, we learned that hunting conservancies for Marco Polo sheep trophy hunting, which is this huge horned species of wild sheep that lots of people from Europe and North America love to hang on their walls, the horns anyway. These hunting conservancies, these big swaths of regularly patrolled land, are home to the most healthy Marco Polo sheep populations, and therefore the most healthy snow leopard populations, because snow leopard rely on sheep as a source of food. So you see conservation happening in the oddest places and the most uncomfortable ways along the Silk Road, and it really makes you realize, you know, the biggest borders in the world are those in our own minds, and especially our hearts and the ways we think about things. You'd be hard pressed to find, you know, your average Sierra Club card-carrying member who would support trophy hunting, and yet that's the best hope for wildlife in Tajikistan. So I love travel because it forces you to confront these ambiguities and see shades of gray where before you saw black and white.
We're talking with Kate Harris about her remarkable new memoir, Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road, about a trip that she and a friend took by bicycle from Turkey to Tibet. And we'll be back with more of our conversation with Kate Harris in just a moment here on the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. We're talking with Kate Harris. She just published a new memoir called The Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road, about her travels along the Silk Road by bicycle. You can join the exchange this morning by calling us and asking questions, making comments. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. You can also join the conversation by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Kate Harris, you write in your book that perhaps the great task of modern explorers is to connect, and it seems like you have just some wonderful encounters with the locals just about everywhere you went. I wanted to ask you about the kind of standards of hospitality that you encountered, because it seems like the greatest degree of hospitality that you got came from the people with the least to offer.
Yeah, that was certainly true, and it's a pretty humbling thing, exchange to be a part of, when you sort of see the material poverty that people are living in, and yet the sort of spiritual generosity and warmth that they have to riches that they have to offer, and it really makes you question your own. You know, what are we rich in and what are we poor in? We're all rich and poor in something, and I'd much rather fall on the side of the generosity, the sort of which I was the recipient of all along the Silk Road. And I almost think the more you have, the more you have to lose, the more you're afraid of being taken from you. And so perhaps it's easier in some respect to be open to passing strangers when you don't have much to lose. But I also think that puts it in to terms that are far too economic. I mean, there's a real sense of community and, I don't know, neighborliness that seemed alive on the Silk Road in a way that you don't find in North American communities and cities. And I do wonder if that's a function of us being so focused on getting ahead ourselves.
So could you characterize some of the highs and lows of the hospitality you received? I mean, I keep wondering, was there any incident where you just you looked at your friend Mel and said, boy, this guy's a jerk. Let's get out of here.
Gosh, I mean, the highs are sort of too many to mention. Just incredible meals and zany conversations, of which I understood, I'm sure, only a fraction of what was what they were trying to communicate. Lots of hand gestures and hilarity. As far as lows, I do talk about the highs in the book, and there aren't too many lows that I describe. I think people think I'm holding something back, like what bad things happened that you didn't write about, but
yeah, we're interested in the dirt, right?
Yeah, exactly. Scandal and conflict. But I think the hardest part in terms of hospitality was there being too much of it, and Mel and I just getting burnt out of having to be social and sort of answer the same questions night after night. So I think just carving out solitude in the midst of so much incredible, generous hospitality was the biggest challenge, and we really did not have any negative encounters with people. And, you know, you could describe that to fluke and luck, and there's certainly that element, I'm sure. But at the same time, I think the world is a lot kinder and more open than we give it credit for much of the time.
But sometimes it takes energy to be a good guest, I guess.
It does. It can be pretty exhausting, especially when, you know, like a handful of phrases in whatever language you happen to be dealing with, and you're otherwise sort of a puppet for your ideas and what you want to say. It's a lot of like performing.
So another thread in your book is you keep referring to explorers from earlier times who may have come through areas that you encountered on the Silk Road. And it seems like a lot of them end up, just like your experience with Marco Polo, they end up a little bit disappointing to you when you sort of dig into their lives. I think particularly about your description of Charles Darwin.
Yeah, poor Darwin. I'm pretty hard on him. But essentially, I was so entranced by Darwin's voyage on the Beagle and his journals from that time and his incredible, like, intellectual excitement about what he was seeing and experiencing and the sort of puzzles he was grappling with in his mind through his travels. And he was this sort of like passionate, poetic young man out there in the world. And then I read his, when I was studying at Oxford, I was assigned to read in one of my classes, his autobiography. And it's just really sad. So he, over time, he essentially never traveled again after the voyage of the Beagle. But that wasn't the most disturbing part to me, you know, the fact that he stayed home. What was more disturbing was he just seemed to withdraw from wonder. He describes himself as a machine for grinding through facts and churning out theoretical frameworks. And he lamented the fact that, like, he used to be able to look at a wild landscape and just feel this intense joy. And now he felt nothing at all. Like, these things horrified me to read. And maybe part of it was just getting old. Maybe part of it was he did have a pretty tragic family life. He lost a child he was very close to. He just seemed very worn down and very far from the sort of searching, questing, restless Darwin that I had become acquainted with in his earlier work. And so that transition terrified me. You know, how does that happen? How do you lose that wonder and curiosity that so propelled him initially and then was just gone? And in some ways, in Darwin's case, I think it was kind of a matter of specialization, like just intense focus on, he really honed in on certain scientific problems and really blocked out a bunch of the rest of life. And so as a counter to Darwin, you can look at Alfred Wallace, who also came up with the theory of evolution by natural selection. So very Darwin-like character, you know, a naturalist who traveled the world. And he never lost his sense of wonder and never settled down, both in terms of ideas or place. He was always sort of curious and questing. And so he shows that it is possible to sustain that, that we don't have to grow up in some ways.
So you see Darwin as somebody that you don't want to end up as, right?
Yeah, just a sort of sad trajectory. You know, he made incredible contributions to the world in a scientific sense, but did that have to come at the cost of his sense of wonder? And Wallace shows that it didn't have to. I mean, Wallace was never as famous or renowned or celebrated as Darwin in his lifetime. And maybe that's the trade-off. Like, you know, maybe you can't have it all.
Kate Harris's book is Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road, about her journey with her friend Mel by bicycle on the entire Silk Road. Kate, on your first short Silk Road bike trip, which was, what, only couple thousand miles, maybe. you had a posse of guys who were more or less traveling with you, including one who was a bike mechanic. And but the second time around, it was just you and Mel, and you know, you were more or less on your own. So being two women alone on the Silk Road, did you ever feel threatened? I mean, you skirted the border of Afghanistan, for example. I mean, these are very dangerous parts of the world.
We didn't ever feel directly threatened. I think the sort of sketchiest encounter we had, I describe in the book, it was basically we stopped at a truck stop in Uzbekistan and ended up in this stuffy room with a whole bunch of men that had been drinking a lot of vodka, and it just felt uncomfortable from the moment we came in, and we just like quickly left. Nothing might have happened, probably wouldn't have happened, but it just felt uncomfortable. So we were really wary as to who we accepted offers of hospitality from. You know, with a mother with two kids in tow, saw us bedraggled and soaking on the side of the road in Turkey and invited us home, we'd go gladly. But if it was a lurching guy with alcohol in his breath, we'd kindly turn him down. But there's only so much of that you can do. I know there's always risk, but in our case, I feel like it was only an advantage to be two women traveling together, because I think women everywhere looked out for us, went out of their way to make us feel welcome and safe and at home. And I don't know that you'd have the same reception if you were two sort of sweaty dudes with big beards rocking into random towns. I think too, you know, so much violence against women happens, first of all, at home, and second, I think from people that a person is acquainted with. And so I tend to feel you're no more at risk, you know, in a remote stretch of highway in Uzbekistan than you are back home, and probably far less risk. Probably the most dangerous place for young women to be alone in the world today is like college campuses across North America. So I think we have a really skewed understanding of what is risky and what is worth doing despite the risks.
Yeah, interesting perspective of the Silk Road, because one of the images that we all have about the Silk Road is that it's a not only is it a trade route, but there's smuggling of, you know, everything from drugs to people. There's spies, all sorts of sketchy activity. But it doesn't sound like you really encountered any of that.
Yeah, we tried to pick the sort of safest seeming through line down the Silk Road. You know, there are many Silk Roads. You can take any number of variations on the route we took to get sort of roughly from Europe to Asia. And yeah, we checked travel advisories. We stayed away from sketchy areas and sketchy countries in some cases. Just tried to be really, really conservative in the choices we made, while knowing that, yeah, there are risks everywhere, but it's still possible to move through the world and be safe.
And Kate Harris, two of the most, to me, compelling images from your book of places that you visited, both were in China, a glacier and a desert. Tell us about those.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing the glacier you're referring to is the Sichuan?
Yes, yes.
Glacier? Yeah.
Did you actually visit that on your trip, or is that a different
trip?
No,
it was sort of one of the great failures of the trip. So we plotted our route sort of weaving between different wild borderlands along the Silk Road, and the ultimate one we hoped to visit was this glacier bordering China, Pakistan, and India. And it's called the Sichuan Glacier, and it's famous for being, kind of sadly, being the world's highest altitude battlefield. It's this hunk of ice that is hotly contested between India and Pakistan specifically, and they have soldiers posted at heights that few mountaineers would dare linger at year-round, fighting over this piece of ice. And so we wanted to, for me, it's the pinnacle of human absurdity and longing, and maps are all tied up in it, and the history of exploration is tied up in how it got to be this conflict zone today. So I was obsessed with this glacier, and I studied it for my master's degree at Oxford. And so the Silk Road trip was kind of designed to get us there at the end of our journey, and that would be the sort of final borderland we investigated. And of course, you know, we get there, and it's still a war zone, and still very much not open for foreigners to just wander in and explore. So we never got to lay eyes on the ice that pretty much propelled the whole trip. And I write about this in the book, in the sense that, you know, I was disappointed, but it, at the same time, it was a reason to go and not a place to reach necessarily. And all you need for a journey is a reason to go.
Well, with that that statement, we'll wrap things up this morning. Kate Harris, thank you so much for being with us. Kate's new book is Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road. So many other amazing places that she visited on her trip that we didn't touch on. But Kate, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for your conversation.